The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Variety Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericavariety.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
This program contains explicit content and subject matter which may be unsuitable for some listeners. Discretion is advised. Sex Out Loud is brought to you by Good Vibrations, creating a buzz since 1977.
Smart, sexy, kinky, fun.
Welcome to Sex Out Loud with your host, sex educator, author, and filmmaker, Tristan Taramino. It's sex-positive radio like you've never heard before. Tristan talks about sexuality from every angle with leading authors, experts, artists, and icons. From sex education and sexual politics to BDSM and non-monogamy, nothing is off limits. So get ready to open your mind and expand your horizons. This is Sex Out Loud. And now here's your host, Tristan Taramino.
Welcome to Sex Out Loud. Today I'm talking to the author of the provocative new book, What Do Women Want? Adventures in the Science of Female Desire. Research on female desire and arousal is a topic that's very close to my heart, and I assume it's close to the hearts of many of you, my listeners. But it's also one that is still woefully underrepresented in mainstream media, desperately underfunded in the United States, and selectively used to propagate certain stereotypes and myths about female sexuality. So I'm excited to talk to someone who spent 7 years looking into the current research around women, desire, arousal, pleasure. And in the meantime, I want to give you just one simple answer to the question, what do women want? Because some women want high-quality feminist porn, and that's what I make. So here's my shameless plug for my latest film, which is from Adam and Eve. It's called Tristan Taramino's Guide to Bondage for Couples, and it stars James Dean, Adriana Luna, Danny Wilde, India Summer, Samantha Ryan, Michael Vegas, Skin Diamond, Derek Pierce. It's fantastic. It's out now, and you can get it at my website, puckerup.com. But as we all know, lots of women want different things, and that's what we're going to dig into today. Daniel Bergner is a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine and a critically acclaimed author. His previous books include God of the Rodeo, The Quest for Redemption in Louisiana's Angola Prison, which was a New York Times notable book of the year. In the Land of Magic Soldiers, a story of white and black in West Africa, a Los Angeles Times best book of the year, and The Other Side of Desire, Four Journeys into the Far Realms of Lust and Longing. His writing has also appeared in Harper's, Mother Jones, Talk, and the New York Times Book Review. Welcome to Sex Out Loud, Daniel.
Well, thanks, and it's great to be talking with you.
As I said in my intro, today we're going to talk about your most recent book, which is What Do Women Want? The introduction kind of dives right into the middle of all of this research. And for me anyway, I didn't get a clear picture about what brought you specifically to write about this topic.
Okay, so there's the long answer and the short one. I'll try to give one in between. My previous book, The Other Side of Desire, led me to a lab in Toronto and brought me to a researcher who said, hey, now that you're up here, you've really got to go into the lab of my wife, Meredith Chivers. She's doing fascinating research that no one has yet really written about. And so I met Meredith Chivers, and indeed she was doing fascinating research, partly focusing on the difference, the very consistent and wide difference between what women say turns them on and what their bodies say. And once I'd spent a little bit of time with her, I just wanted to spend more. She was on this great journey, and then I wanted to branch out from there and spend time with other researchers, and finally, but really importantly, spend time interviewing what ended up being scores of women so that I could thread some of their stories through the book. That's really how the book came into being.
And it opens with your writing about Meredith Chivers research. She's from Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario. Can you describe the way that some of her studies work and what she has discovered as a result of them?
Yes. So let's start with what I was watching when I first met her. She was showing an array of porn, which I'll detail in a sec, to men and women, both self-identified straight and gay men and women. And that array of porn was all sorts. So men with men, women with men, women with women, men alone, women alone, and bonobos, a species of ape having sex. And the men were very predictable, kind of boring in their responses, really. What they said turned them on, and what their bodies said matched up perfectly, and indeed, they were responding, the gay men, to images of men, and the straight men to images and video clips that included women, and any idea that men primal would respond at least a little bit to those apes having sex was completely off track, total flatline, nothing doing. So all very sort of straightforward on the male side. On the female side, though, a completely different story. So women were responding physically to everything, including those bonobos having sex. And yet when they told their own subjective story, non-physical story of what they were turned on by, it was very limited. So straight women were saying that images with just men involved turned them on, and gay women the opposite. And they were saying, no, the bonobos did nothing. So it was this really interesting pattern that began to suggest a few things. Number one, the old idea that women are less visual when it comes to sex, kind of ridiculous. These responses, at least the physical ones, powerful and immediate. Number two, any idea that women are kind of more limited in their sexuality, somehow less libidinous, also immediately called into question. And then there was this riddle presented, why the difference between what the body is saying and what the mind is saying when it comes to women's sexuality.
And what, so that's one of the big questions the book raises. Tell me some of the things that you posit could be contributing to this real discrepancy between these physical results and what women self-report.
Right. So it's important to say up front, I don't think anyone, not Meredith Chivers, not me, is saying, hey, the body, the physical response is the capital T truth about desire. And in fact, it's important for me to say, especially since I'm a man, I am not, my book does not contain the final all-encompassing answer to the question presented on its cover, what do women want? Not anywhere near to that. I don't intend that. This is a book of exploration. But I do think it's a book of exploration that turns some assumptions upside down. And so to get back directly to your question, this gap could well be explained by the fact that our culture seems so sexually unrestrained, and some people would say sexually saturated, but it's still giving a different level of permission to men and women when it comes to sexuality. And so there may well be, for women, an aspect of conscious denial, maybe, about what the turn-ons are, and more probably an unconscious level of denial or filtering, a disconnection between body and mind that doesn't exist for men, because as researcher after researcher told me, our culture just gives more permission to men when it comes to lust, when it comes to desire.
And I also want to talk about the fact that this arousal is measured in just one way with this plethysmograph, which is this glass tube that measures the amount of blood flow to the vaginal walls, which also measures wetness or lubrication. Is that, am I explaining that correctly?
Yes, you've got it right. And I should have sort of set up a visual picture of what's going on in the lab better in my original answer. So what the subjects, men and women, are hooked up to is the male or female version of the plethysmograph. So measuring effectively general blood flow, or for men, erection level, which is the same as general blood flow. And then each subject has a keypad or in their hand by which they're indicating their own, you know, awareness of arousal, their own sense of being turned on. So, yes, you've got that exactly right.
But one of the things that this raises for me is that there is actually, like, the equivalent doesn't necessarily exist. I mean, I feel like if we're going to measure erectile tissue in the penis, say, then we should be measuring erectile tissue of the clitoris versus lubrication or just blood flow to the vaginal walls. But my understanding is that there is no way to measure as of yet the clitoris or its responses. Is that right?
I mean, we may be getting too technical here, but to pause on this for a sec. So you're mostly right. There's no ready way to measure shifts in clitoral size. Even if there were, we'd be ignoring something pretty important, which is that the clitoris has pretty significant extensions, in fact, ones that rival the penis for size, that are underneath the surface of the skin. So certainly we couldn't be measuring shifts in their swelling. What is beginning to be possible is measurement of heat. And so with thermal measurements, you can start to measure shifts within the clitoris. And you may be right, that may be a better equivalent. So far, what scientists have seen is that the same kinds of patterns are revealed when you use the clitoral measurement as opposed to the genital blood flow measurement. So you're still getting this gap between mind and body, and the difference between the female and male sets of responses. So the same kind of fascinating riddles are presented.
Okay, we've got to take a break and hear from some of our fabulous sponsors, one of which has everything to do with this, and that is Astroglide. Astroglide lube makes sex better. We've been talking about getting wet. You can get wetter with Astroglide. You can go to astroglide.com to get a free sample. We are going to talk about a lot more. This book covers a lot more information about female sexuality, and I've got a lot more questions for Daniel. So stay with us. More Sex Out Loud when we return.
Streaming live, the leader in internet talk radio, VoiceAmerica.com.
Enhance pleasure for you and the ones you love to love with Astroglide personal lubricants. Astroglide provides that extra oomph in creating a better and more exciting sexual experience. Astroglide's wide product range allows you to pick and choose based on personal preferences. All the products are also latex condom compatible, allowing for safer sex practices. Astroglide values the benefits of a fun and healthy sex life as part of a happier lifestyle, and so should you. For more information and a free sample, visit astroglide.com and get your sex life to blast off today.
Good Vibrations is the San Francisco Bay Area-based women-friendly retailer trusted for more than three decades to provide a comfortable, welcoming, and safe environment for quality sex toys, educational materials, and products that enhance and empower one's sex life. Good Vibrations offers its products at 6 retail locations in San Francisco, Berkeley, and Oakland, California, and in Brookline, Massachusetts, as well as online at www.goodvibes.com. Online ordering is discreet and trusted. We believe that pleasure is your birthright, and one of our highly trained staff members can help you choose the product that is perfect for you at 1-800-BUY-VIBE. Call us 7 days a week from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Pacific Time at 1-800-289-8423 or visit us online at www.goodvibes.com.
Ready to take your sex life to the next level? Let Tristan Taramino's award-winning Expert Guide Sex Education Series help. Each DVD is packed with honest information, explicit techniques, scorching sex scenes, authentic chemistry, and real female orgasms. Go to puckerup.com and use coupon code SEXOUTLOUD for 25% off your order.
You're tuned in to Sex Out Loud with your host, Tristan Taramino. We want to hear from you. If you have a question or comment, please send an email to Tristan at puckerup.com. That's Tristan at puckerup.com. Now back to the show.
Welcome back to Sex Out Loud. Today I'm talking with Daniel Bergner, the author of What Do Women Want? Adventures in the Science of Female Desire. I do want to remind everyone out there that August is Anal Pleasure Month, and you can celebrate with Good Vibrations, the San Francisco-based retailer trusted for more than 3 decades to provide a comfortable, safe, and welcoming environment to find sex-positive, quality products and educational materials to enhance and empower your sex life. Go to goodvibes.com, and all this month, they're running a bunch of different specials. They've got anal sex classes. They've got an anal sex history timeline, which I helped write. There's a whole bunch of stuff there. So please go to Good Vibes. And while you're there, you can use coupon code TristanGoodVibes for 20% off your purchase of $100 or more. Okay, back to Daniel and his book. So Daniel, a lot of what we think we know about female sexuality comes to us via evolutionary psychology, which has posited a number of theories that have seemingly been absorbed quite readily by our culture. I'm hoping you can first tell me what some of these basic theories are, and then how you have found in your research some contradictions to them.
So the overarching theory of evolutionary psychology when it comes to sex is that men are programmed by evolution to be promiscuous, to spread their cheap, limitless seed, and women, by contrast, to seek out one good man and thus to be at least relatively well suited to monogamy. I think, you know, as much as we as a culture have absorbed this, we've done that without really examining the science beneath that theory. And when I went back to the original academic papers, I found circular reasoning, flimsy evidence, and meanwhile was spending time in laboratories that were debunking that very theory. So really, there is no reason, none at all, to believe that women are better suited to monogamy than men. In fact, practically speaking, when you look at some of the science, women may be even less well suited to monogamy when we're talking just about sexuality. And so we're left with this very human problem. We want love. We want security. We want permanence. We want closeness. But these may not be the things that bring us lust, that bring spark and, you know, erotic passion to our relationships. And one of my hopes with the book, and by combining science with individual women's stories, is to spark a different kind of conversation, a much more candid conversation about women's sexuality and about who we all are sexually and about how that all fits in with our longings for love.
Well, this raises the point that you make in the book and that some of the research that you cover it supports, which is this notion of the familiar as a killer of lust and libido and desire. But I'm wondering, there was no mention of Esther Perel and her game-changing book, Mating in Captivity, in your book. And to me, she is the queen of this particular theory that the more you know someone, the more it kind of kills your ability to lust after them, desire them, see them as the other.
Well, Esther is who I know is certainly one of, and perhaps one of the few psychologists who's been willing to speak honestly and speak forthrightly about the problem of closeness getting in the way of erotic passion, rather than the old trope, which we've heard over and over, which is that somehow women's desire depends on emotional intimacy. You know, one of the things that's always occurred to me is how comforting that is for us men. It's really nice for me to think that while my eyes may roam and while I may depend on the new, you know, my partner's eyes are mostly focusing on me and depending on closeness with me in order to feel lust. So anyway, getting past that kind of unsettling truth. No, I think you're right that Esther is one of the really strong thinkers here. There are others. Marta Mayana, who I write about quite a bit in the book, is one. What was most striking to me, though, is how much therapists still cling to that idea that if you can make the relationship stronger, if you can improve communication and improve intimacy, that you're going to increase lust. And I am quite convinced by those I've spoken to, but that's just not reliably the case. We're kidding ourselves and telling ourselves a story that may be convenient for therapists, but maybe is looking away from the realities of our sexuality.
You mentioned Marta Mayana. She actually puts forth this fascinating theory, which is about the role of narcissism in female desire. Can you take me through that and how this narcissistic element, the desire to be desired, plays into women's fantasies?
Yeah, so she didn't mean narcissism in a condemnatory way, just in a descriptive way to capture that very spark that you just mentioned, the desire to be desired, the desire to be desired uncontrollably. And that came up over and over again as I spoke with women. So one quick example, Isabel is in her young 30s, wrestling whether to marry her boyfriend, who's very attractive, who's adoring, but for whom she's lost desire over the couple years they've been together. And she thinks back often to a previous boyfriend who was very fierce, I guess is a good word, in his desire for her. And I don't mean by that violent, but very, very focused and always suggestive of the uncontrollable in his lust for her. And that held a lot of power, and she felt really tormented by her loss of desire for the man, perfect on paper, the very attractive boyfriend who's also very sensitive, and to pine for that lust of the previous boyfriend, which was less sensitive and more aggressive, just more overpowering sometimes. And that was a theme I heard over and over from women as well as from the researchers and therapists.
So I had a different take on this Isabel story because it struck me that part of why the sex was so good was that he was slightly unavailable. He was sort of critical of what she wore sometimes. Like he would like to sort of pick what she wore, and he liked her in these clothes that weren't necessarily her taste. So like they had these kind of conflicts, which I felt like increased the desire because it increased the distance between them.
I think you're right. I think both elements sort of speak to the same thing. He was at least somewhat, maybe ultimately completely unavailable. Thus, complete closeness was impossible. And then that brings us back to what we were just discussing, that it's distance that desire thrives on. After all, desire requires maybe a kind of objectification. Objectification has become an evil word, but it may also be an essential element to lust. And that sort of, that objectification means that there's a capital O other. It means there's a distance to cross. All of these are essential ingredients, I think, to our feeling erotic power, erotic charge.
But then I feel like we're back into this territory of these insidious romantic comedies, which is like the guy who is unavailable is the one that totally makes you hot, and the emotionally available, sensitive, ready to commit right on the spot guy, you just feel like, eh, he doesn't do it for me. Am I settling? You know, I feel like there's also this sort of cultural narrative which Isabel kind of falls into, which is based upon these fantasies we have of what it means to actually feel desire and feel turned on, and what that should feel like, both emotionally and physically. You know, I feel like some of this requires a kind of a rewiring of our brains, because we all have desperately unimaginative and unreasonable expectations for how sex works.
Yeah, I love the question, because it gets at something that drove me to write the book in the first place, and that is that it's so difficult to separate out, to unweave the cultural from the biological, and in a sense, that's the wish of the book, and that's the wish of the researchers I was spending time with. It's a quixotic one. We really probably can't get there. But like all the great questions, there's no final answer. But part of the pleasure for me was in getting inside that conundrum of culture and the innate. So yes, I don't know how we're going to get past our social scripts. Not sure we finally can, but we're certainly, maybe the idea is we can gain more insight into the ways that we inhabit those scripts and fight against them. One last thought occurred to me as you were speaking, and that's the idea of unconditional love. We search for that. We give that a very high value when it comes to our romantic relationships. And to take Esther's arguments maybe one step further, maybe unconditional love, that's the demon here. The closer we get to unconditional love, the further we may get from lust. Because after all, you know, unconditional love is something we may have gotten, if we're lucky, we hope to get, you know, legitimately from our parents, but it's not really what we should be after, I think, in our lovers. I think we need to be earning love and earning lust all the time and not expecting that it be there for us unconditionally.
And I would argue that unconditional love breeds simply a different kind of lust and a different kind of attraction. And it's one that we've got to get more comfortable embracing, because otherwise we're going to be kind of stuck on this, you know, hamster wheel of wanting the new, the unfamiliar, the stranger, the unattainable. You know, I feel like, yes, I mean, I feel like we have slightly different takes on that, because I don't think that we need to create kind of artificial distance. And I think unconditional love can be magical, but then you have to cultivate this other sexual dynamic within that unconditional love.
And now I should be interviewing you, because if you have a way to combine unconditional love with erotic bliss, then you should have provided the substance of the final chapter of my book. Believe me, my editor would have been much happier, because I would have been offering a truly happy ending rather than some glimmers of hope.
Well, I don't know that I have all the answers. I just have a few theories. And certainly one of them is about monogamy. I mean, I've written a book on non-monogamy. And so I'm also one of the proponents that we examine this cultural institution. It may not be working for people sexually. It may not be working for people in a whole bunch of other ways as well. So all those arguments about monogamy were very, you know, really resonated with everything that I know in talking to people who have chosen to practice ethical non-monogamy. But we're running up against another commercial break. We've run over, actually. So we've got to take another break. We're going to catch our breath. We're going to talk coming up about how the pharmaceutical industry comes into play here, and some other questions about this central question of what women want. So stay with us. More with Daniel Bergner when we return.
The Internet's number one talk station.
Number one talk station.
VoiceAmerica.com.
Good Vibrations is the San Francisco Bay Area-based women-friendly retailer trusted for more than three decades to provide a comfortable, welcoming, and safe environment for quality sex toys, educational materials, and products that enhance and empower one's sex life. Good Vibrations offers its products at six retail locations in San Francisco, Berkeley, and Oakland, California, and in Brookline, Massachusetts, as well as online at www.goodvibes.com. Online ordering is discreet and trusted. We believe that pleasure is your birthright, and one of our highly trained staff members can help you choose the product that is perfect for you at 1-800-BUY-VIBE. Call us 7 days a week from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Pacific Time at 1-800-289-8423. Or visit us online at www.goodvibes.com.
Ready to take your sex life to the next level? Let Tristan Taramino's award-winning expert guide sex education series help. Each DVD is packed with honest information, explicit techniques, scorching sex scenes, authentic chemistry, and real female orgasms. Go to puckerup.com and use coupon code SEXOUTLOUD for 25% off your order.
You're tuned in to Sex Out Loud with your host, Tristan Taramino. We want to hear from you. If you have a question or comment, please send an email to Tristan@puckerup.com. That's Tristan@puckerup.com. Now back to the show.
Welcome back to Sex Out Loud. Today we're talking with Daniel Bergner, the author of What Do Women Want? Adventures in the Science of Female Desire. What some women may want is simultaneous clitoral and G-spot stimulation during intercourse. And if that describes you, you may want to check out the WeVibe. WeVibe is one of the sponsors of this show, a big supporter of mine, and they've created a sex toy that is truly unique, and it's meant to be hands-free and worn during penetration and intercourse. So check it out at WeVibe.com. Daniel, as we know, and this has been covered extensively, the pharmaceutical industry is spending billions of dollars in search of a, quote, female Viagra, a drug that can help fix women's low desire, fix our sex drives. And, you know, this could have a potentially huge financial payoff. So it's one of the only areas where there's money actually being pumped into research on female sex and desire. But why do you think all of that research has been such a dismal failure up till now?
Well, great question. I guess the simple answer is because we're dealing here with the mind, and the mind is a very, very complex thing. So, you know, Viagra for men, pretty straightforward in the end. We're dealing with mechanical issues of blood flow, and those are more or less solved by this chemical. But with the so-called female Viagra, and that's really a misnomer, we're dealing with desire, and we're dealing with the neurotransmitters, the brain, and how they in turn are affected perhaps by hormones. It's a much more complex system. You know, what I felt so lucky about, when it came to the chapter where I follow the development of the drug, was that I was really invited in to see the development from the inside. And that gave me a glimpse of two things that I thought I could bring to readers. One was a real sense of the neurology of lust, what the brain is doing when we are in a state of desire. And the other was a sense of the politics of how drugs get approved. And that's a very fraught politics when it comes to this particular prospective drug, the female desire drug, fraught because of the following. So more than one company told me that they worry along the way that their results may be too strong, and that the FDA might deny their application for fear that the drug was going to cause or unleash a kind of legion of nymphomaniacs.
Oh, and this is one of my this is one of my favorite parts of the book. And this is especially true for this drug, flibanserin,
which has a horrible name. Came up with more than one company. But yes, I did have a glimpse inside the process with flibanserin and then with Libertose. And, you know, that was funny to me the first time I heard it. It's kind of still funny to me still, but funny and horrifying. What it says is that we're still, even, you know, in the year 2013, we're still in a society that is frightened when it comes right down to it of female sexuality and talking in terms of, oh no, what if, you know, we've got a population of nymphomaniacs, drug-created nymphomaniacs. And on our hand, that was just so striking to me and spoke so loudly about the cultural forces that are at work.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because what it speaks to is this notion that we want to make money off of women and their sexual problems, but we also still firmly want to control them. And we don't want them to be too sexually adventurous, too sexually desirous, too libidinous, because then what? I mean, that's the other question. Then what will happen? And I think that there's some part of our collective subconscious which believes that women with desire that is big and needs to be fed will somehow dismantle society as we know it.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's, again, funny and yet not funny. To put it on a personal level, you know, look, I've been at this subject for 8 years. So on the one hand, I'm kind of inured to the very fears we're talking about. But on the other hand, I have to admit, as a man, you know, every time I talk about this, I think about my girlfriend and I think, it still unsettles me to really confront what's just inarguably true about female promiscuity being the equal of male promiscuity or promiscuous impulses anyway. So that's on a personal level, and I think that applies to men, you know, across the board. Certainly I've heard that again and again from male readers. And then I think you're absolutely right. On a societal level, it's been so convenient to cast women as the natural protectors of stability, you know, as this kind of social glue. And to let go of that notion is to feel like the earth's moving a bit beneath our feet.
Yeah, I mean, I'm always fascinated that when people ask me about non-monogamy, their sense is that men are running the show, that men are taking their female partners and kind of dragging them by the heels into swinger parties or polyamory or some form of non-monogamy. And it's like men have the wandering eye, men have the libido, and women have sort of thrown up their hands and said, oh God, okay, I'll figure out how to make this work. And in my experience, women are much more often running the show and in fact have more partners and are getting more sex. They're getting more sex in these circles, not men. But I think it's like this secret fear that they don't want to know that women actually want more sex, want more variety in sexual partners. People want to kind of make this into this like patriarchal institution that just simply can't be broken, because the flip side of it seems terrifying to people.
Yes, alas, for me as a man, I think all you say is right on target. And I'm thinking of a woman whose story I tell, Passy, who's in her late 50s. She loves her husband mightily, but she also feels like something's missing in her sexual life. And it's really, in the end, she, not he, who leads them toward a life of sexual experimentation and polyamory. And I remember once sitting in their dining room kitchen and she acknowledging with him there, yes, this was more my wish than his. And, you know, that speaks to exactly what you're saying. And it's all, yes, unsettling for us men. We don't like to think along these lines.
I will say that I appreciate your honesty on this. But do you think that informed anything about your writing of the book? Did that inform the lens through which you saw certain things or decided to include some things and not others?
Inevitably, probably yes. I mean, I try to be objective and approach this as a journalist, but of course, I am also a human being. So I'm sure my own lens is not completely clear. You know, what I hope, though, is true at the same time is that 8 years of listening and asking and asking and asking and listening and listening and listening to scientists, Muslim women, and to women, everyday women, talking about their sexual stories, adds up to a book that's largely filled by women's voices. So I hope it's their answers and not mine that are, you know, filling the book and coming in response to the question, what do women want?
Okay, we're going to take another break and hear from our fantastic sponsors who make this show possible. Coming up, we're going to talk about the arousal desire model. I wanted to talk about the G-spot and some other places in the book where I want to challenge you a little bit. So so the fireworks are coming, listeners. No, I'm kidding. Stay with us. More talking about What Do Women Want with Daniel Bergner when we come back.
Stimulating talk
gets those synapses in the brain firing really fast.
All the time.
The number one internet talk station where your opinion counts. VoiceAmerica.com.
Turn off the TV and pick up the remote control that is sure to please. Worn while making love, the WeVibe 3 features whisper quiet motors that will keep you anything but quiet. We can't help it if the rechargeable battery lasts longer than you do. Learn more about the world's number one vibrator for couples at WeVibe.com. WeVibe. Share the pleasure.
Good Vibrations is the San Francisco Bay Area-based women-friendly retailer trusted for more than 3 decades to provide a comfortable, welcoming, and safe environment for quality sex toys, educational materials, and products that enhance and empower one's sex life. Good Vibrations offers its products at 6 retail locations in San Francisco, Berkeley, and Oakland, California, and in Brookline, Massachusetts, as well as online at www.goodvibes.com. Online ordering is discreet and trusted. We believe that pleasure is your birthright, and one of our highly trained staff members can help you choose the product that is perfect for you at 1-800-BUY-VIBE. Call us 7 days a week from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Pacific Time at 1-800-289-8423 or visit us online at www.goodvibes.com.
Ready to take your sex life to the next level? Let Tristan Taramino's award-winning Expert Guide Sex Education series help. Each DVD is packed with honest information, explicit techniques, scorching sex scenes, authentic chemistry, and real female orgasms. Go to puckerup.com and use coupon code SEXOUTLOUD for 25% off your order.
You're tuned in to Sex Out Loud with your host, Tristan Taramino. We want to hear from you. If you have a question or comment, please send an email to Tristan at puckerup.com. That's Tristan at puckerup.com. Now back to the show.
Welcome back to Sex Out Loud. Today, we're talking with Daniel Bergner about his new book, What Do Women Want? Adventures in the Science of Female Desire. Daniel, this book ultimately raises more questions than it answers, which you yourself admit, and I think is always a good thing, because it speaks to just how complex these issues really are. But it seemed like on a few points, you took some things at face value and didn't really interrogate them enough for me as a reader. So I want to challenge you about a few things. Are you ready?
I am ready.
Okay. One thing that frustrated me is that I feel like you contributed to the bad science around the so-called mythology of the G-spot, because you wrote that its existence is still up for debate. Do you really still believe that the G-spot is up for debate?
Look, my job as a writer is to listen and, you know, what I'm hearing and, of course, what I'm reading. And I think by now I've read almost everything out there on the subject is that there still really is a debate. Now, that astonishes me because, as I say, again and again, and when it comes to various aspects of women's sexuality, anatomical aspects of women's sexuality, it's amazing that in the 21st century, science hasn't settled these questions. And related to this, the fact that it was only a decade ago that anatomists really acknowledged how extensive the clitoris is right underneath the surface of the skin is one more statement of how science and society has looked past women's sexuality, has minimized it. But to circle back, do I still think there's a debate? You know, we'd have to pull apart on the show all the science. My gut tells me that the debate is going to diminish over time, and we're going to settle on the yes answer. But the fact is, credible scientists are still yelling at each other over this one.
I know they're yelling, but I feel like the preponderance of evidence is on the side of the G-spot. I feel like these articles that get released that say it doesn't exist are really problematic, and often they're based on either self-reporting or these so-called literature reviews, where they literally don't talk to a single woman or do a single physical exam. They just do these literature reviews, all these dudes, and then they publish it and say that the G-spot doesn't exist. So I feel like the on the side of the G-spot doesn't exist is just crappy research and science. I just do. I do. The G-spot exists, people. I'm here to tell you. It does.
Okay. And fortunately for our discussion, there can really be only one person here, and that's you, who has any direct evidence. So I'm going to defer to you for the purpose of this conversation. You know, I think the chapter I write about this kind of lays out the argument more or less fairly. But
I think it was missing the Italians' research. So I think some of the most compelling research about the G-spot is by these Italian researchers who've done several studies where they've done imaging and they've also done a combination of a look at the size of the urethral sponge versus self-reporting of women who say they enjoy G-spot stimulation and G-spot orgasms and that there's a correlation. Like if you have a big urethral sponge, a lot of tissue there, then it's also true that you self-report that you love G-spot stimulation. So I think the Italians have this locked down. I do. I'll send you those links.
You better include the French in there because I'm pretty sure there's a French team involved.
There's a French person too. Okay. So so the next thing we need to talk about is Rosemary Besson. Rosemary Besson has created a model of female sexual desire and arousal that basically it's this very critical theory about how arousal can and does precede desire for lots of women. And it contradicts the Masters and Johnson linear model where desire always precedes arousal. I have my own issues with Rosemary Besson and there's some things I disagree with her on, but I think the core of the theory is pretty radical and rings true for a lot of women. But you take a few pages to kind of, you know, dismiss her pretty easily, I think.
Well, I think there's a fundamental problem with Rosemary's approach. It's not that it's without value. I think as another way to look at sexuality, but I think that inherently it diminishes the sexual drive for women. It takes us backward. In a sense, it's almost, I'm going to overstate things a bit here, but it's almost Victorian in its outlook. It tells us that while for men for men, lust is a drive, for women, it's something responsive, merely reactive, slow in developing, and for that matter, not particularly invested in climax. So it takes the primal out of women's sexuality, and I think there's a real risk in that. It takes us back really to that evolutionary psychology model, which Rosemary herself has cited in support of her vision of sexuality. And again, I really find that problematic.
I mean, I agree with you that this notion that what women want from sex is emotional intimacy, and then if they get emotional intimacy, they're more likely to want sex again, you know, this kind of circular model. That's a problem because I think at the end of the rainbow for many women could simply be pleasure, release, you know, pure physical drive, orgasm. That could be their goal and their intended place that they want to get to. And that's not represented in her model in its kind of purest form. But I do feel like there is a way in which we have this idea of what desire is, which is you see your partner across a crowded room and you want to rip their clothes off and you don't care if you set your house on fire. You're just desperately wanting to have sex with them. And that exists at a certain point in lots of relationships, but it can't be sustained over the long term. And if lots of us are in long-term relationships, we've got to figure out a different way to express and receive the signals of desire. And in Rosemary's case, it means why don't we like get things started and see if in fact desire then comes after arousal?
Yeah. And so, like I said, as an additional way to think about desire, I think Rosemary's model has a lot of value. As a primary way, and I think the problem I'm pointing out in the book is that it is all too quickly become the preferred way to think about women's desire, and it's been kind of enshrined now in the latest DSM, the Psychiatric Professions Bible. It is really problematic, in partly because the Sun Circle ends with cuddling, basically, rather than climax. And while cuddling is great, and I want it too, trust me, after sex, to put it there as, you know, the end, the desired end, is, I think, really to drain something away from our understanding of women's desire.
Absolutely. And I'll admit, when I teach the Rosemary Bisson model, I have basically adapted it. And I have all sorts of shortcuts which bypass cuddling. Anyone can tell you that. My diagram, there are other ways. There are other routes to go. So you can bypass cuddling altogether. We're out of time, Daniel. I want to apologize because we had a great question from Sean on Facebook. Sean, I'm sorry I didn't get to your question. I obviously had too many questions, but that's what this book is all about. So thank you so much for being on the show, Daniel.
Thank you. It's great to talk to you.
Daniel Bergner is the author of What Do Women Want? Adventures in the Science of Female Desire, published by Echo and available at bookstores everywhere. You can find out more about him at his site, danielbergner.com. And he is a less than frequent Twitterer, at Bergner Daniel. All of these links and more can be found at sexoutloudradio.com. Click on the link for episode resources. I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible. Executive producer Karen Dana, associate producer Raymond Johnson, segment producer and editor Colton, announcer Cooper Beckett from Life on the Swing Set, Paul Joannides, the author of Guide to Getting It On, and Emily Nagoski, who blogs at thedirtynormal.com, really helped me research this week's show. So thanks to both of them. Thanks to my engineer, Randy and Roland, and my usual engineer, Matt, and everyone at Voice America. If you missed any part of the show or want to hear it again, you can listen on demand or download at voiceamerica.com. Tune in next Friday at 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern, when my guest will be blogger, author, and speaker Greta Christina, talking about her new book, Bending: Dirty Kinky Stories About Pain, Power, Religion, Unicorns, and More. Until then, I encourage you to keep the discussion going on facebook.com/asktristan, on Twitter @sexoutloudradio, and in your own life. Take some time to talk about sex out loud.
That's a wrap on today's show. Go to voiceamerica.com to listen to this and other episodes on demand or as podcasts. And make sure you come back next Friday night at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 Pacific, for Sex Out Loud with Tristan Taramino on Voice America Variety.
Sex Out Loud is brought to you by Good Vibrations, creating a buzz since 1977.